Well, good morning. In here at home, we are so glad that you are with us this morning. Well, it was at the beginning of the year, which feels like a lifetime ago, another world ago, that one of our adult classes started studying and reading in a book, Canoeing the Mountains. It is a book that was about church and Christian leadership, and it used as its guiding metaphor the Lewis and Clark expedition, along with the Corps of Discovery, and their attempt to find the Northwest Passage, a route all the way to the Pacific Ocean. It was in 1803 that then Thomas Jefferson commissioned Meriwether Lewis and William Clark. William, was that you or a different? Okay. I think he said that was a different person than him. But they gave them these instructions. The object of your mission is to explore the Missouri River and such principal stream of it in order to find the most direct and practicable water communication across this continent to the Pacific Ocean for the purposes of commerce. Now that's a handful of what was just described there, but they're trying to find the fastest water route to the Pacific. This was 60 years before Transcontinental Railroad would even begin to connect parts of the West to the East. And so if you wanted to do extensive commerce, then you had to do that through water routes. You had to do that on water. So Lewis and Clark set out on their expedition, and they went out with assumptions that had been around for European colonizing nations and then the United States for some 300 years, and that was they were working off the assumption that there was some water route, some way to make it from one side of the nation all the way to the other, to the Pacific. And so they were under the understanding that they could travel the Mississippi and then they could travel up the Missouri River, and it would either connect with or get close enough to the Columbia River that they could carry their boats, their canoes, just a little ways, and then plop down in the Columbia and ride it the rest of the way. So after 15 grueling months of travel, much of it upstream, they finally arrived to what they were convinced was a turning point, the Limhi Pass at the Continental Divide. They believed, Lewis believed, as he walked up the hill of the Limhi Pass, that he would look down and there would be a gentle slope that his men would take, and it would take maybe half a day carrying their canoes. And then they could put the canoes down in the Columbia River. And instead of going against the flow, they would go with the flow and quickly, smoothly take the Columbia River all the way to the Pacific Ocean. That's what they believed. That's what they hoped for. Those were the assumptions that this expedition and so many others before them were working off of. So when he got to the top of the Limhi Pass, and he looked out over what was ahead, what he saw was nothing like what he expected. Instead of a short, simple walk with their canoes to the Columbia River, what they saw was the Rocky Mountains. Or as one person in their expedition wrote, the most terrible mountains I ever beheld. Beautiful mountains to look at. Delightful to ski. Horrible to try to walk across on foot. Even harder if you're carrying your canoes. This is not what they had imagined. This is not what they had planned for. This is not what they had been working for months. This is not what hundreds of years of assumptions had led them to believe that they would find. So the question is, how do you canoe the Rocky Mountains? And the answer is, you don't. You can't. You either abandon your mission, give up, and turn back, or you adapt. Adaptability is a choice, a determination to adjust, to modify your approaches, to bend and flex and change, which does not mean an abandonment of your core values or your core mission. In fact, in many ways, the only ways we keep pressing forward to the goals that we have, to what's critical to the heart of who we are as individuals, as families, as businesses, as a church, during a time like this, in ever-changing landscape, is we adapt. Like the Corps of Discovery realized at the Limhi Pass, you've got a couple of choices. You can abandon your mission, or you can adapt your methods and your mindset. You cannot alter the landscape of what lies ahead, but you can adjust your attitude and your approach as you move toward what lies ahead. Now, I want to talk for a few minutes about someone who I think serves as a model of adaptability, a great example of adaptability, although I'm not sure we would always think of this person in these terms. I'm talking about the Apostle Paul. Think about Paul's origin story of becoming an apostle in the first place. It is all about adaptability and a willingness to adjust in the face of new information. Paul had spent his life, he describes, studying and training and being around other people who all had one particular understanding of the way the world worked and the way the Word was taking the people of God. In fact, he was so sure of the way in which he was going that he was willing to persecute and lead persecution of the early church. But most of us remember the story. He has this encounter that changes everything. He encounters the risen Lord on the way to Damascus, and he realizes, although he thought his whole life he had been dead right, he was dead wrong. Now, I've known some people who seem proud of the idea that they've hardly ever changed their minds or practices in decades and decades of their life. And my question would be, are you sure that's something to be proud of? Because unless your knowledge or your attitude or your actions are already perfect, then your goal should be ongoing openness to growth. Growth in what you don't know, growth in what you're doing and are not doing, or the New Testament would call that maturity. Growing into maturity. Those in the early parts of the Restoration Movement, of which Churches of Christ are a part, had a saying that guided them during a time of ongoing transformation. And their saying was this: wherever God through the truth may lead us. Wherever God through the truth may lead us. Adaptability is openness to the Spirit, to teach us new things we don't know and take us new places we need to go and transform us into the people that God wants us to be and calls us to be and creates us to be. And if you look at Paul, adaptability was central to his mission. So there is this well-known passage that I want you to listen to again. It's one that I think a lot of you have heard, although it may be new to some of you. It's a passage in which he describes foregoing some of his preferences for the sake of sharing Jesus. 1 Corinthians 9:19, though I am free and belong to no one, I have made myself a slave to everyone, to win as many as possible. So to the Jews, I become like a Jew to win the Jew. To those under the law, I become like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I become like one not having the law, though I am not free from God's law, but am under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I become weak to win the weak. I have become all things to all people, so that by all possible means I might save some. Now you can imagine, but you don't have to imagine, because you can read it in the New Testament as well. But Paul's opponents, you can imagine the ways they would hear something like that. They would see that lived out and say, Paul is not a man who is true to his convictions. But what is Paul saying in that passage? It is because of my convictions that I'm willing to adapt who I am and how I go about living out the mission of God in order to connect with different people in different places, in different circumstances. The same gospel compels him forward in every situation. But the same gospel compels him to adapt and adjust depending on the landscape that he's traversing at that time. And adaptability is key to Paul's ability to handle his wildly fluctuating situation, not just in his mission, but in his life. Okay, so I've read in the past, and I've heard stories about how engineers and architects go about the challenging task of building buildings, especially high-rise buildings, in earthquake zones. In fact, I went down a little bit of a YouTube rabbit hole just watching some videos on that this week, and I can tell you some more details at another time. Now, I don't claim to be an engineering expert, so I'm not going to try to present myself as such. But if you want to build one of these buildings, especially high-rise buildings that can survive in earthquake zones, then you still have to have a solid foundation. We understand that. And you want top-notch materials, materials that are strong and they're going to make it, and we understand that. But there's something especially fascinating. It's not just about strength. If those buildings are going to make it, there has to be flexibility. Those buildings have to have the ability to move and sway a little bit, because if they are too rigid, they'll crumble. So I want you to watch just a brief video, and this was from an earthquake that was going on in Japan, and someone videoed two high rises in the middle of this earthquake. Let's watch. Okay, I've got a couple of responses. One is, oh my word, could you imagine? Could you imagine not just being the one who was filming that, looking at that, could you imagine the people who were in those high rises as those things swayed back and forth? But it is because of their ability, their engineering, their design to be able to sway, to flex, that allows them to stay together in the midst of earthquakes. Now, I want you to think about, from what you remember of Paul's life, some of the earthquakes that he lived through on his own. the highs and the lows, the ups and the downs. Listen to his attitude that he describes in the middle of those from Philippians 4:11. I have learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do all of this through him who gives me strength. Our daughter Anna had a preschool teacher, her pre-K teacher, Miss Karen, who had a saying that she liked to go back over and over day after day. And it's a saying maybe some of you have heard at different times as well. This is what the kids would hear throughout the day. You get what you get and you don't throw a fit. Ever heard that one? Ever say that one? You get what you get and you don't throw a fit. So a kid says, hey, they got the coloring picture that I wanted to get. Or another kid says, well, I got goldfish, but I wanted graham crackers. And Miss Karen all the time would say, you get what you get and you don't throw a fit. Now, I used to think of contentment along those lines. In need of plenty, in need or in plenty, hungry or well-fed, I get what I get, and I don't throw a fit. And that's not a bad approach. That's a good start. But the more I've studied the word Paul uses here, the more I've realized that there's something else going on. This was a word that was used a lot in his day, and it was a word that was used by the Stoics. But it meant more than just not silently suffering. I don't like what I got, but I won't throw a fit. And contentment is not simply being satisfied in any situation. In fact, some situations, like in the face of injustice, call for us not to be satisfied. So we act. So we do something. The way contentment was understood is that it is being sufficient to the task no matter the situation. So the Stoics grabbed onto this word, and it was something they aspired toward, contentment. And when they used it in a way that means self-sufficiency. I am self-sufficient enough to make whatever situation I find myself in work. That's what they were after. If they had a lot or if they had a little, they were content. They were self-sufficient. They could make it work. Self-sufficiency is independent of all the external circumstances in which we find ourselves. And so Paul grabs onto this word that was very common, and he uses it both in a way that was very familiar, and at the same time, he turns it on its head. So he talks about what they would have talked about. He can have a lot or he can have a little. He can be hungry or well-fed. He can live through the highs. He can live through the lows. He can live through the situations where the ground beneath his feet is shaking and moving at a terrible pace. But it's inaccurate to say that Paul simply lands on the Stoic mindset, that he simply digs deep within. What Paul says is it is internal strength that he's drawing on, but it's not isolated to himself. The internal strength is the Spirit who lives in him. It is the God who sustains him. It is Jesus that goes with him to give him strength. You tell me we don't have much, I can work with that. You tell me I have a lot, I can work with that. No matter the situation, no matter the supplies, no matter the circumstances, I can make it work, Paul says, because Christ is at work in me. I can make it work because God is at work in me. I can make it work because the Spirit is at work in me. is working through me. I don't have to tell you that we are in the middle of one of those times as a nation and as a world where the ground underneath us is shifting. We are in one of those times where we've hit a place where what lies ahead is not exactly what came before us, where everything is different. And most businesses don't have a choice. It's to give up or adapt. If you are inflexible in your business during a time like this, then like a skyscraper in an earthquake, you will crumble. And families haven't had a choice. The end of the school year last year, different than any of us expected. The summer, all kinds of plans were changed. All the extracurriculars, those have been adapted. They've adjusted. And now we're at the beginning of a school year with all the weirdness this brings. And it's not like a school year that most of us have lived through. And we still don't know what's coming in 2 weeks or a month or 2 months. And so we can act as if the world around us isn't going through this turmoil, that we're just going to hunker down and until a vaccine comes, or we adapt, we adjust, we find new ways to learn, new ways to have fun as a family, new ways to keep our sanity. And churches all over our nation have had to adapt in countless ways, in ways I never could have imagined 7 months ago. For those of you who are at home, if you come to church, you'll notice no more greeting one another with a holy kiss. We loved that as a church. If you're a visitor, you've never been here in person, man, holy kiss, we were all over that. No more. No more right hand to fellowship. No more hugs right now, at least for the foreseeable future. Just an awkward wave from a distance. The occasional elbow bump, which just feels weird. A few times people go in for a fist bump. I don't know if that's a great idea. But we've got 10-gallon size hand sanitizers here at the church, and so we just kind of bathe through it as we walk in and walk out of the place. Things are different. We've joked about it a lot here. Communion is different. Not just the way we go through it, but even the elements. People at home, you know it's bad because it gets mentioned every other communion. That the wafer is cardboard. It's still dissolving in my mouth right now. There is a piece lodged at the back and it hasn't gone down. I'm just fighting through it the best I can because we have to adapt. That's what we do. But here's the thing. Times of trauma, times of change, can also be places where the Spirit comes into our life and comes into our families and comes into our church and does something new, does something amazing. If we are open, if we are willing to adjust and adapt to this new terrain that we've never walked on before, that we wouldn't have chosen, but here we are. This is what lies ahead. We can turn back or we can walk forward in faith, trusting that the same Spirit who's walked with us to this point will continue to walk with us into this uncharted territory. And part of the benefit, part of the glory of this time that I would not have chosen is all the ways that we've seen the giftedness of the Spirit working through our members. More members involved in the service than ever were before. Voices that have been lifted up in Scripture and in prayer and in song, in sharing wisdom and testimony and life experiences. We are in a situation I would not have chosen, and yet the Spirit of God has been faithful in opening our eyes to all the ways that God has gifted us as a people all along. And we might just find that this is a gift we don't want to turn our back on. We continue to see the ways that God works through our people. And here's the thing that ministers and church leaders all over the nation are talking about right now. Not just how long will this last, because none of us knows, and it's already lasted longer than I anticipated, and probably longer than some of you anticipated. But the question that we're wrestling with is this: what will be different when this is all over? Because as individuals, as families, as a nation, you don't go through major traumatic times like this and come out the exact same person on the other side. People are asking questions about God, about the church, about their faith that they've never asked before. And people are coming out on the other side and in the midst of this in ways that they never have before. And the question is, when we get to the end of this, whatever the end of this looks like, and some things look the same, but some parts of the landscape looks different as well, will we be a church, will we be a people who can adapt to the new world when this is over, who can meet the challenge in faith with the Spirit as our guide, willing to follow where Jesus would lead us so we can minister in the name of Christ, not in an abandonment of the mission, but in fulfillment of the mission to new people in a new world, in a new landscape. We're going to close this morning after a song with a special prayer for our teachers. Here at the beginning of the school year, teachers, I want you to know that we know how challenging this year is, how challenging the end of the last year was. We know, teachers, that so many of you are already overworked and you're underpaid even before you meet a challenge like a semester that you're about to face or that you've already started to face. And we don't know all the ways that you've had to adapt, but we know you've had to. I live with a teacher who has worked hard to get ready for a semester and is already has a contingency plan because there's a good chance that the semester she's planned for is not the semester that will be in a month or so down the road. So teachers, we are praying for you. We appreciate you and the work that you do, but I also want you to know that we're confident in you. And we're confident in you because of this. The same reason I'm confident in you is the reason I'm confident in the rest of us, even though we are in some serious uncharted territory right now. It's because no matter the situation, no matter the circumstances, I believe that you are sufficient to the task. You can make it work because Christ is at work in you.